And I believe that in this country, at least, payment systems and regulatory systems run way behind the pace of innovation. So I think it's my job as a leader and my team to say, look, here is a way that we can care for these patients in a better way that's more predictive, more preventative, improves their patient outcomes, and or reduces costs, to prove those models of care, and then go to the payers and the regulators and say, look, here is a way of doing something that surely you can see is better.
Welcome back. This podcast is a summary of a conversation I had with Lawrence Tallon, the Deputy Chief Executive of Guy and Thomas's NHS Foundation Trust in London. I truly enjoyed hearing about his career path and found it inspirational on so many levels. Now, Mr. Tallon is a great communicator, and I expect that you will enjoy his story tremendously. Lawrence shares his background, highlighting his non-clinical but broad education, and his career shift into healthcare due to personal circumstances and his mother's battle with cancer. He candidly discusses challenges and opportunities in the NHS, as well as the importance of innovation, research, and technology in improving patient outcomes and operational efficiency. Tallon emphasized the need for systemic reform, such as better integration, collaboration, and adoption of successful innovations across different NHS trusts. He touches on the problems of centralized control and the importance of local leadership, suggesting a balance between national direction and local flexibility might be best. Tallon also discusses the potential for digital technologies, artificial intelligence, and process innovation in transforming healthcare delivery in the NHS while addressing payment and regulatory barriers. So let's jump right in with a simple question. Tell us about yourself, Mr. Tallon.
Sure. So, well, firstly, thanks for coming to visit me and delighted to have you here, Stefano. Well, I'm from London originally. I grew up in Cambridge. It's my hometown, Cambridge. So I guess you could say I've been fortunate to live in places where there's a lot of tech, a lot of talent, a lot of innovation. So that's kind of part of how I grew up. I'm not a clinician, although I work in healthcare. I'm not a clinician by background. I'm actually a historian. That's what I did at university. And I went to a school called the School of Oriental and African Studies. So I have quite an international outlook. It's actually traditionally the college or the school that trains people to go into the foreign service, the diplomatic service. And I was going to the diplomatic service on the back of that. That was my career track. And for various reasons, I had a change of track when I left college. My mother at the time was unfortunately terminally ill. And so I decided I couldn't go to the diplomatic service because I was doing a lot of caring for my mother, a single parent family. So it was a lot for me and my brother. So I decided I shouldn't go overseas at that time. And so instead, I went into the domestic government service. So I went into the health service. And I guess there's a couple of things that shaped my experience there. Firstly, the fact that my mother had a diagnosis of terminal cancer when I was a teenager and we were a single parent family meant that we were facing a pretty bleak outlook when we were teenagers. We were going to basically be without our mother, our only parent. My father is alive, but we didn't live with him. But we were lucky because we lived in Cambridge and because that meant that our local hospital was one of the most specialized cancer services in, certainly in this country, one of the most in the world. She was enrolled in a clinical trial, which against all of the statistics, all of the odds, gave her another 17, 18 years of life when the prognosis would have been about 12 months if we were lucky. So what's that taught me? Well, it's taught me the importance of academic medicine, of discovery, of research, of clinical trials, of innovation. Because from a very personal experience, if you're lucky enough to have the benefit of that kind of academic healthcare, it can be transformational for your life. So really, my whole career since then has been not just around healthcare, but around innovation, learning, discovery, research. How can we break new boundaries and give the sort of opportunities I had to everyone as a part of our normal healthcare?
Yes.
So I went into the government service. So I had about a decade in the centre of government in Whitehall, just over the river there, pointing at Stefano for those that can't see. And I had 10 years really in the centre of government. This was around the New Labour years. I was not a political appointment. I was a permanent appointment, what we call a civil service appointment. And of course, the US and the UK are a bit different in that the majority of the people who run the government in this country are not affiliated with one political party. It's a relatively thin layer. Of course, in the US, you have a far bigger a transition between one government and another. So I was actually there for mostly the New Labour years, and I caught the early part of the Conservative and Liberal Democrat coalition. And I love being in politics. I love being around that. I love being in public service. There's a great phrase that someone I work with said that stuck in my mind, which is, if you're in the healthcare in this country, you either want to be close to ministers or you want to be close to patients. And pretty much everything in the middle isn't really that much fun. It's a bit of a blob. So for me, I enjoyed really being in the center of Whitehall around government policy, very exciting. But I wanted to come out and do something different. And for me, that is getting closer to where the patients are. I'm not a clinician myself, but I'm in a privileged to be in a position where I work very, very closely with some world-class clinicians and scientists. And my job is to help them be in a position to provide the best possible patient care.
I really love Lawrence's genesis story, if you will. His very positive experience with the NHS, giving his mother the opportunity to raise her children, and then going to work in Whitehall on behalf of his fellow citizens to work on the policy side of healthcare. So what next? How to further enrich his skill set?
I had a little interlude, though, overseas. So when I came straight out of government, I mentioned that I had previously been destined for the diplomatic service. And that was an itch I kind of wanted to scratch. So after my mother passed away and I was more able to move, my kids at that stage were quite young. We went to the Middle East for 5 years and I worked for a big academic healthcare provider in the Middle East, which was both a fascinating experience in its own right, but also gave me the opportunity to travel a lot as well, not only in the Middle East, but around Asia, to the States, around other parts of Europe, to really get to know other parts of other countries, other health economies, and see what's good and what's not so good. So I was a director of strategy at an organization called HAMAD, which is, it's a bit like the National Health Service in this country in that it's the publicly available provider for the state of Qatar. It's a population of about 2 million, so a small country, but it essentially has one big hospital group called HAMAD. And so I was director of strategy there. It's about 8 hospitals, about 3 billion US turnover. Gives you a sense of the scale. I often think, and particularly having had the benefit of maybe traveling around the world a bit more, getting to work in some other countries, see some other health systems, I think the UK as a country, and I'm not just talking about healthcare here, it suffers from the problem of intermediate scale, by which I mean it's big enough, one of the larger economies in Europe, one of the larger in the world, it's big enough to think that it has got all the answers within its own borders, but it's not actually big enough to have that. And I think, without getting kind of too much into a different issue, if you look at the Brexit referendum, it's a perfect example where history and geopolitics is taking us towards big agglomerations. And for us in Europe, our natural agglomeration is with Europe. And we're in that sort of position where our home is within Europe, and our unique proposition there is a sort of mid-Atlantic model of a more enterprising, free market part of Europe compared to the rest of Europe. And it is a massive historic error for us to take ourselves out of that agglomeration. And I think with the rise of China, with the rise of India, with the power of US, the only way we've got an opportunity to be a real global player is as part of Europe. And I hope at some point we will revisit that. In terms of how that plays into healthcare, the NHS has a poor record really of looking outside its borders about what works well in other places. And I think part of what I hope to do is bring some of those lessons. And I'm fortunately part of a European Health Leaders Network called Siana, which is looking at Germany and Switzerland, about how can we learn from what's good in other parts of Europe. The NHS at the moment, the National Health Service in this country, is in a very interesting place. And at one level, it's in a very negative place. But I see that as an opportunity. I'll come on to why that is in a minute. So if you look at our public satisfaction, we have a stable data set called the British National Attitude Survey. And in the first decade of the century, well, so before the first decade of the century, the NHS was not in a great place. It didn't have a great public reputation. Two things came to the rescue. A political settlement to say we're going to invest in public services. This is the New Labour years. But most importantly, a really strong economy, which has actually developed under the previous government and which New Labour inherited. So I'm not particularly making a party political point here. The economy allowed us to invest. And we put significant investment in the 2000s. Most of that improvement that came about was more money and more people with a largely unreformed model of healthcare. By the end of that decade, 70% of the people on that British Social Attitude Survey said they were either satisfied or very satisfied with the health service, which for a taxation-funded public service, 70% being satisfied, that's pretty good. That figure is now 24%, because post-world financial crisis, post-austerity, we have, and obviously post-pandemic, we've got disinvestment, we've got a crumbling infrastructure, we've got a burnt-out, unhappy workforce. Waiting times, which are the main determinant of public satisfaction, have gone much, much longer than they were at the end of the 2000s. All of this is very gloomy. However, I'm a glass half full person, as are you, Stefano. And what you could say is that in the 2000s, because we had a strong economy, we threw more money at a service which got better and bigger, but not fundamentally more productive or more modern. When you have nowhere else to go, as we have now, because our economy is in a pretty weak state, GDP growth is way behind the US, obviously way behind China and India, Western Europe and the UK. If we're lucky, GDP growth is about 1% in real terms. It's really weak, really anemic. See, we don't have the opportunity to throw more money at it. We don't have the opportunity to throw more people at it because we can't afford it and those people aren't coming through training. Leaves us only one opportunity, which is what we didn't take last time. And that is real innovation at scale driven by new technologies. And we'll come on to that in a minute, but I believe we have barely even begun to tap the opportunities of new digital and biotechnologies, which can really transform healthcare over the next generation. And I certainly wouldn't want to give the impression that there wasn't reform. So there was a really seminal document in the year 2000 called the NHS Plan, and the subtitle was A Plan for Investment and Reform. However, those reforms, they were sort of quasi-market-based reforms, and I think they were quite effective. They were a good thing to do. What they did is they essentially meant that there was a greater incentive for provider organizations to drive up quality and drive down cost in order to attract more patients that came with income. That was a largely fee-for-service payment system. It wasn't really a Kaiser capitation-type payment system. We do have capitation in primary care, but that's a pretty thin slice of the overall health economy. We don't have capitation for that bigger chunk of acute care. You probably never want capitation for the really specialized stuff. The big challenge for us is how to make capitation work on primary all the way through to acute care model. And that was not done. I am a fan of what happened in the 2000s in terms of reform. But my main point really is, why did the health service get so much better in that decade? It was predominantly more money thrown at the, broadly speaking, the existing model of care, and more people paid for by that money. It wasn't a fundamental transformation using new technologies. Now, in fairness, if we look at how technology has changed over the first quarter of this century, the opportunities now are exponentially greater for reform. So I'm not critical of what happened in 2000. I'm very positive. What I'm saying is, because we don't have the economic strength we had there, we've got only one opportunity, which is really to harness these new technologies to drive up quality and drive down cost.
Not everyone will agree with the relative benefits of being part of the European Union for Great Britain, but Lawrence makes a good point about the fact that in those relatively rich years of good economic times, the NHS made some important reforms that led to 70% of the electorate feeling favorable towards the NHS, the National Health Service, but that this is largely driven by extra spending. However, this go-around, with the approval rating being as low as 25% for the National Health Service, and Great Britain suffering from a struggling economy that simply can't just pump more money into the system, he sees technology and systematic innovation as the way towards system modernization. And as Sir Winston Churchill is credited with saying, I'm not sure he did though, one should never let a good crisis go to waste. Let's see what else we have to learn from Lawrence.
So I think if you can picture in your mind's eye a 2x2 grid, and on one grid, we talk about automation and AI. And I'm thinking at the kind of left-hand side of that grid, you're talking about relatively basic automation of functions, robotic process automation we have in things like payroll functions, human resources functions, etc. You're moving through artificial intelligence and machine learning, and then right at the further end of that, you're talking about generative AI. So if we think about that sort of spectrum on one axis, and then we think on the other axis of the business of healthcare from lower risk kind of administrative business functions, billing, coding, back office processes, all the way through much higher risk clinical functions. So you could be talking about quasi-clinical functions like supporting a multidisciplinary team meeting, writing discharge summaries through generative AI, through all the way up to actual clinical decision-making, diagnostic decision-making by, for example, AI reading radiological images and making decisions or recommending decisions. So if we draw that 2x2 grid, we've got four boxes. I think there's a lot we can go at in the what you might call the simpler quadrant. So essentially using mature technologies, not frontier AI, mature technologies that are already in common use in other functions and in either non-clinical or non-interventional lower risk opportunities. So there's a whole lot around back office administration, clinical coding, clinical letters, et cetera, where we are very, very inefficient at the moment. As we get more comfortable, and I think we can lower the cost there and massively increase speed and efficiency. As we get more comfortable with these technologies and as these technologies develop, we can start to expand into those other quadrants, both upwards into mature technologies, into clinical decision-making, and rightwards into more frontier technologies, but in lower risk interventions. And then the top quadrant, where we're talking about less mature technologies, frontier technologies in clinical decision-making, is the last quadrant we will tackle. But there is so much opportunity in those other three quadrants before we get to that quadrant, in my mind, as how I see innovation and reform work in our health service.
I could not agree more. When clinicians and patients think about technological innovation, they think of robotics and AI-driven diagnostics. But in reality, the lowest hanging fruit is in operations. So much so that today the term AI is used to specifically describe software that leverages artificial intelligence to help manage highly repetitive and low-risk processes in and around hospital management and payment systems. Another challenge I see, however, is that technology still costly and needs to be funded. The NHS may be centrally funded, but each of its 300 trusts or local clinical authorities are managed independently. And I was curious how he thought that might play out.
I mean, that is a fundamental problem we have in this system. The way I see that, I think you've got opportunities in agglomeration, so particularly vertical integration, but also horizontal integration. And that's where I see the role of leadership. So just to give you a bit of a background on this organization, we have 5 hospitals. We also have dozens of community facilities. We care for around about 3 million patients a year. Many of those patients are repeat patients, but we'll have 3 million patient episodes a year. And we care for a population across a big swathe of the south of London, which is obviously by a long way the biggest city in this country, and patients from much further afield. So we have scale. And I believe that in this country, at least, payment systems, national regulatory payment systems and regulatory systems run way behind the pace of innovation. So I think it's my job as a leader and my team to say, look, here is a way that we can care for these patients in a better way that's more predictive, more preventative, improves their patient outcomes, and or reduces costs. You know, either reduces costs for the same quality, improves quality, or it improves quality and reduces costs. To prove those models of care, and then go to the payers and the regulators and say, look, here is a way of doing something that surely you can see is better. At the moment, that's costing me money to do it. You now need to get your payment systems to catch up and your regulatory systems to catch up. And the advantage of our scale and our, without sounding too sort of arrogant about it, the reputation that we have as an organization, as a leading center of innovation, research, and high quality clinical care, is that we can talk direct to national policymakers about catching up with reform. So I don't sit there saying, if we do that, it's going to make these patients' outcomes better, but the financial benefit accrues in another organization, so I'm not going to do it. I say, let's go and do that, and then let's work with those organizations to prove why the payment system should catch up to incentivize us to do that. easy to say, not so easy to do, but I think that's got to be the job of leadership in our system. I do not see it as my job to be necessarily the innovator. I see it as my job to be the senior sponsor of the innovators. They're the brains. They're out there. They're doing it. I just give them the cover and let them get on with it. And that, I think, is my role.
It's a key observation about the role of leadership in this context. Some of the most effective systems I've come across are run by leaders with the same outlook as Lawrence. They don't necessarily see themselves as the innovators, or specifically the person who needs to come up with the solution, the innovation. Leaders like this need to have a clear idea as to where they need to go and what outcomes they want to achieve. However, the how, they often leave to their operational leaders. Leave it to them to figure it out. Leave it to them to enable innovation. And if you're a startup that wants to have a successful pilot in a hospital system, that's the kind of leadership you want to look for. Okay, so now moving on, I did state earlier that I think the best bang for your buck with technological innovation right now is in operations, but certainly opportunities in clinical care. And I did ask Lawrence about that, and he had several technology solutions that they'd actually put in place that he was quite happy about, and one that I hadn't considered, genomics.
So I'm not necessarily saying that all of the focus of automation, AI, innovation should be non-clinical. I'm saying I think the lower hanging fruit, the easier things to go for because of the maturity of the technology and the risk tolerance, is some of those non-clinical things. I think that primes the organization to be much more technologically focused. There are lots of things, though, that we can do to improve patient outcomes. So as an example, we've got much better in recent years about providing remote care in the home. So we can get patients out of an acute hospital where their muscles are deconditioning, their opportunities and their chances to go back to an independent life are reducing with every day they're spending in hospital, their risk of infections increasing. We can get them back into their own home, re-enabled to live an independent life or semi-independent life. That's a far better patient outcome. Now, that doesn't necessarily require an interventional technology. That requires things like remote monitoring. It requires a video connection to the patient so you can do a consult with them remotely. It requires sort of normal telecommunications technology. So we're not necessarily intervening in that patient. We might be looking at things like remote monitoring, you know, blood pressure monitoring, respiratory monitoring, etc. But those are not necessarily AI technologies. Those are kind of more mature technologies. So our focus, of course, is improving patient care. But when I also talk about reducing the administration costs of the system, that allows us to invest more money into technologies that are, or not so technology, it could be people, it could be technologies, it could be infrastructure for the improvement of patient care. So all of this, in my mind, is focused on better patient outcomes. Where I'm saying I'm more cautious is going too far, too fast with frontier technologies without sufficient confidence that they are yet ready to be deployed in patients. So one of the technologies we're investing in, I mean, we've gone with Epic here. Obviously, that is not a great example of lowering cost of the system, but it is an important platform technology for us. But if we look at the patient portal part of that, which I'm not sure if it's called this in every Epic system, it's MyChart for us. I'm not sure if that's a common name across all Epic systems. But because patients, before they come in for their consultation, can fill in a load of detail, it can take 7 minutes out of that consultation. Using voice recognition technology in the consultation, the clinician can have that consult with the patient and pre-populate the discharge summary letter, all using established voice technology. Now, of course, they will reread that. But what they would have previously done is they would have dictated the letter to a medical secretary. As you say, we're paying a person a salary to be a medical secretary. You dictate that straight into the system. The clinician will check it, check everything's right. It's pretty mature. They rarely need any corrections. They probably need fewer corrections than they would need with the medical secretary. And so you've taken a whole load of time by doing pre-work with the patient remotely. And then in the consultation, the letter being populated. The other advantage, of course, is it means the clinician gets the letter there in front of them as soon as the patient leaves the room, rather than dictating it to a medical secretary who then gives them a pile of letters a couple of days later that they have to remember. The other neat thing is, as well as taking that time out and the cost of the medical secretary, what clinicians have said to us is when they're sitting in the room, They have eye contact. They're talking to the patient. The patient's talking to them. And the letter's being written. They're not constantly doing this and looking away at a screen and tapping. They haven't. And so there's a sort of intangible qualitative benefit of the patient-clinician interaction as well as those efficiency savings. So that's one of the things we're investing in. And you can see how that, it's not a risky technology, but it's taking costs out of the system. It's creating efficiency. We are also investing in remote monitoring technology so that we can care for many more patients out of hospital in their own home with medical oversight. So we have a lot of patients here who are staying in hospital longer than they strictly need to for medical reasons. Muscle deconditioning, we have a constant effort to try and keep them mobile, keep them active. If we can care for that patient in their own home remotely with a package of remote monitoring support and clinical oversight, we can get them back into their own home, better for their quality of life, relatively low-cost technology, which can be recycled and reused after appropriate kind of checking and cleaning. It also gives us data sets that we can be doing sophisticated analysis about what's happening to our patients remotely all the time, continuous monitoring rather than a sort of episodic concept. We're also investing in some more what you might call high-cost, but will become lower-cost technologies over time. So we are a center for genomic medicine in this country, which of course at the moment is still relatively costly, although the costs have come radically down from earlier generations of genomic sequencing. But we're able now to identify genetic disease, like the example I was just talking about in the meeting before I came here was familial hypercholesterolemia, where we have patients who previously were dying potentially in their 30s or 40s from this undiagnosed condition. We're now able to pick that up for not only for those patients, but for future generations. So the story that one of our clinician scientists was telling me before I came here is that one of their patients is the first member of their family in recent memory to make it to retirement age because their previous generations had been dying before retirement age. This is game-changing technology. At the moment, the cost, of course, is still high, but the cost of sequencing is coming down so rapidly. It's now hardly more expensive than an MRI scan to give someone a whole genome sequence. And that will only come down over time. So I guess there's sort of relatively simple, low-cost technologies that can make the system more efficient. And there is much more sophisticated technology that in time will become relatively sort of standard of care technology, but is really improving patient outcomes.
Next, I was curious to ask him about operational efficiencies in the operating room, exactly what they call the theater. Let's hear what they have to say.
So we have a thing here that we call hit lists, high intensity theater lists, where we run two ORs next to each other in tandem, one surgeon. And it's based on the Formula One pit stop type analogy, where every single piece of the process is completely optimized and everyone in that theater team knows their role and is working at maximum efficiency. And the number of cases we can get through is four times greater than we would get through on a normal process. Of course, we monitor the quality outcomes. Is there any reduction in quality? The quality is at least as high, if not greater, and this is all published. So a super efficient process. We are somewhat hamstrung by the slightly bureaucratic nature of the NHS. We haven't yet normalized that across all of our ORs and across the NHS as a whole, although that program is now being rolled out to a whole load of other hospitals. We had a National Health Commission by the Times newspaper where this was one of the key innovations that was being pushed. So the other key ingredient for that is really careful case selection because it works with non-medically complex patients where you can predict the time for the operation. Once you start introducing more medically complex patients, that doesn't work so well. But there's a huge number of things like cataracts, varicose veins, these sort of patients who are waiting a long time for a relatively simple procedure. We can get through huge volumes. We've done it in orthopedics, we're doing it in cardiology as well now.
Clearly, Lawrence's trust is amongst the most innovative in Great Britain and happens to be one of the largest trusts, which certainly helps. And what I was curious about is how innovation is spread amongst the 300 NHS trusts. When I was working at Kaiser Permanente in California, I was in a team that oversaw operational efficiencies across 20 different hospitals. We used a healthy competition between the hospitals and radical transparency of the results to drive operational efficiencies across the system with great success. The NHS seems to be well suited to using such a strategy. So I asked, how is innovation spread and incentivized within the National Health Service?
Yeah, not well. I think the thing when people come to the National Health Service is they see the N, the national bit, and assume that it operates as a single system. We're often described as a single payer system. To some extent, we are. But it's actually very atomized. And although we have mechanisms to spread, there isn't really a culture of rapid adoption of technology or innovations in other places. So we have this phrase that people say, if it's not invented here, they don't want to use it. And there's been various studies published that it can take 7 years for a proven innovation to be adopted at scale across the system. We do have various national bodies like NICE, which is the National Institute for Clinical Excellence, which is a bit like the FDA, and actually has a very strong international reputation. That is principally focused on pharma and medicines. So when we've proven that a particular medicine meets the quality threshold, the quality adjusted life years threshold, its value for money, NICE will mandate that all hospitals should use it. So it works quite well in pharma. Increasingly, we're spreading that to medical devices and technologies, and it's not quite as mature there, but it's getting better. Where we're less good is what you might call system changes, system innovation. So the one I described about high-intensity theater lists doesn't actually use any technological innovation. It's just process innovation. And really, there's no reason we shouldn't be doing that as the norm across the NHS. And we're doing it in many places. But the NHS is not greater at innovation. I think the two things I see, and this is me being more hopeful about it, is we have got a trend towards agglomeration. So bigger groupings that allow that spread to happen within their own organizations. Various trusts coming together in bigger units. We also have a trend towards vertical integration between primary and secondary and tertiary care. Because a lot of the innovations that really save money or are more preventative and predictive, you really need to capture that full kind of virtual continuum. So that helps you to solve this conundrum about investment goes in at point A, return accrues at point B. If you've got the vertical continuum, you can capture that. And then the other thing, reason I'm hopeful, is what I talked about at the start of our talk, which is we don't really have any other choice. We're going to have to find ways to innovate at scale, or we're going to see this public service that is very sort of dear to the nation's heart gradually erode. And we used to think of our National Health Service as sort of the best in Europe and one of the best in the world. That story doesn't really stack up so much anymore. But I am hopeful that kind of it's darkest before the dawn type thing, which is if we're ever going to innovate, if we're ever going to embrace the opportunity of technological innovation, now is the time to do it. And we do have the technologies, both mature and emergent, to really, really make this happen. And a phrase that I sometimes use is, if you look at history, this is my being a historian piece, healthcare has its ups and downs, it can have moments of retrenchment, but it always gets better over time because of technology and human ingenuity. Life expectancy improves over time. We're having a bit of a blip, but it always gets better over time. So healthcare, in my mind, using these new technologies, healthcare will get better. The question is, where will it get better? Will we be in a situation like we are with electronic health record systems where we let it get better in the US and then we import them at great cost? Or will we be a leader in Europe, in the UK and in Europe? The geopolitics of importing mature technologies from other parts of the world like China are very, very complex. So I think both for geopolitical reasons, for economic reasons, we have an opportunity in this part of the world, in the UK, working with European partners and American collaborators to say, we're going to use these new technologies. We're going to innovate at scale to design healthcare really fit for the middle of the 21st century and to be a leader and an innovator, not an importer of mature technologies from another part of the world.
A recurring theme across Europe when it comes to the digital health sector, and actually technology writ large, was the realization that occurred probably during COVID, the pandemic, that the interdependence of a global economy had left Europe behind in many technology fields, from telecommunications to artificial intelligence, and apparently electronic health records. The EU, therefore, has increased short-term funding to encourage the development of innovative solutions and technologies across most industries, including healthcare. And time will tell if they can catch up. However, there are far simpler solutions that do not require AI that can be implemented to identify and minimize duplication of care and other expenses. Mr. Talon has some thoughts on this, and they're quite compelling.
So And I've worked in the centre of government and I've worked in hospital systems. So I kind of get both lenses. Yeah. This country, as you say, we've got the opportunity of a single payer system and a single thing that people recognise the national health system, but it doesn't work as the national system. And when the government or the ministry, the relevant ministry, Department of Health, says you must do this, it tends to be behind the pace of innovation. It's a bit, I mean, you think of sort of Eastern European central planning economies. You've got that risk of you want to maximize your scale. You want to use the benefits of your scale, but you don't want to have centralized decision-making because it tends to slow innovation. The way I see it working in this country over the next few years is how do we provide the best possible quality at a manageable cost? I think you need to be in a situation where you can enroll patients into your, let's call it your plan, your insurance plan, and be fully incentivized to provide the full continuum of care for them from primary care all the way through to acute care before you get to really specialized things like transplantation. And for that, primary through secondary to be on a capitation basis. So we are incentivized to give that patient the best but the most efficient care. And it's only the really specialized stuff that is a paper procedure or whatever. So your risk pool is established. Now, of course, that in a US system, if Kaiser does well, people will enroll in their plan. If Kaiser doesn't go well, people will not enroll in their plan. We don't quite have that system here, but we could have. So our system of registration, our system of insurance is a national system of insurance, which is accessed through your family medicine practitioner, through your general practitioner, as we call them. Now, if we had a situation, let's say in this part of London, where the main hospital provider joins together either contractually or organizationally with its network of family medicine practitioners, as a single organization, or at least as a single contractual body, and we look at all of our patients that are enrolled in our plan through their family medicine practitioner, and we start monitoring those patients on both a cost basis and on a clinical risk basis and say, these are our patients that are costing us a lot of money. How can we really care for those patients much more upstream, much more proactively and preventatively? Then you use the scale and the muscle and the financial heft of the hospital system, which is where the majority of the money is in the health system. But you move that upstream to support your general practitioners to work closely with the hospital physicians to treat those patients as effectively as possible. So you effectively get the benefit of an insurance system managing risk as proactively as possible, an investment and return being within the same organization. Then you get to a situation where we use new technologies to say to patients, okay, if you like, let's call it the St. Thomas's plan, you can enroll on your, you click this QR code, you enroll on our plan. If you decide you don't like the way that that service is caring for you, you can enroll in a different plan. You go on the App Store and you choose a different QR code and you switch your registration to a different family medicine practitioner working with a different hospital, let's call it St. Bart's Hospital. And then you get the benefit of the insurance model where we're all trying to provide the best possible care at the lowest cost. But you also get the benefit of competition, which is if I get lazy as a provider and I'm starting to not provide great customer experience or quality outcomes, they can switch their registration and go somewhere else. So you get the benefit of healthy competition, but also the benefit of the insurance system. And what won't happen in this country, I don't think, what will be unhelpful, and we see that, you know, the complexity of major payer reform with Obamacare, to try and fundamentally change the payment system is so big and complex and politically contentious and time-consuming. It's a huge distraction. But you can do that within the existing payment form by basically joining together general practitioners and hospital systems to form a Kaiser-like single body, and then to monitor those patients on a per-patient basis for the highest quality, most efficient care, tech-enabled, and give those patients a choice. Because that's the fundamental thing you've got to have, which doesn't work so well in our system. When a provider isn't doing well, patient has to have the opportunity to take their insurance, their national insurance, and take it to a different provider. And so those providers have to stay ahead of the game, just like Kaiser. Otherwise, people will leave and they'll join another plan. So I think that can happen in our context, taking the best of what's happened. You know, the other system I look at is Clalit in Israel, which I don't know if you're familiar with, but it operates on a similar basis. A country of size that's a bit closer to our scale. It's smaller, but a bit closer. So I think this can be done. And that's a reform, I think, which is actually more about systems reform than it really is about technology. The technology is just an enabler. It's a population health play. And I think you can, within our system, because we are a single payer, you can put parameters around that competition. So, for example, I don't think you want forms of hostile competition. I think you need the ability to, I guess my fundamental philosophy is, How does any industry or any sector ever fundamentally transform itself unless the consumer has an element of choice? So I think we've got to say, look, a grouping of healthcare providers that are providing great quality at a manageable cost, patients can choose to shift their insurance. So looking at the history of public services in this country, there is a national role to create conditions for innovation. But innovation of a complex system of this type, as opposed to a technical challenge, like, for example, building a spacecraft or building a nuclear weapon or something like that, I don't think it happens well by national government mandating things. I think it happens by getting clusters of innovation, which are healthcare organizations, often working with a leading university, to innovate. And the national role there is to give them the right incentives, the right scale, the right opportunities to innovate, not to inhibit innovation. So I think the part of innovation that it's discovering and pushing ahead and saying, here's a better way of doing something, we're going to try something, I think that needs to happen in local clusters of innovation. What you must then have, like in any experiment, is a systematic process to say, this is now proven, end the experiment and make that the standard of care. So what I wouldn't advocate for is a sort of let everything rip and allow for massive divergence over time, because you've got the equivalent of a Kaiser in London, say, that's doing great things, but Manchester has got a really poor version, and therefore the people in London get a much better service than the people in Manchester. That doesn't make sense. What does make sense is to say, let those people in London try that, let the people in Manchester try that within guardrails. And once we've now observed that natural experiment and we can see which works better, we're going to now say, okay, experiment over. That way, the Manchester way is better or the London way is better. Everyone's going to do that. So I think that's where the national role is, to observe and spread.
Okay, and here I push back a bit. Would it be better for government to stick with setting targets rather than mandating protocols? Just because Manchester worked better than London, does it mean that either solution will work in Liverpool? Wouldn't it be better to say, hey, look, this is the target. Manchester and London both hit it, so we know it can be done. Liverpool, this is now your target. We expect you to hit it. And if you want to visit London or Manchester to see what they did or use this playbook we created for you, great. But if not, have at it. But you must meet the target or, you know, somebody gets fired.
I do. I think that's exactly what should happen. And I think you say, we've proven under these conditions, with this amount of income or revenue, with this type of population, it's proven you can achieve this level of attainment. And by the way, we're telling you now that's what we expect you to do. We're not telling you what you have to do, but if you would like to look it up, here's three places that have shown it. And by the way, we're facilitating it. That's where I think the national role is. That I totally agree with that. We're part of a group called the Shelfer Group, which is 10 of the leading university hospitals, where we're great at sharing because we respect each other as peers. So it's not like you told Manchester's better than London. You're told, look, London's great. Manchester's great at some things. Why don't you go and see what they're great at? And we'll show you what we're great at and we'll share it. So there are ways of doing that. And that I totally support. And the size of our country lends itself to that well. You know, it's easy to get around quite quickly. We all speak the same language. With one time zone, it's very easy to do that. And we should do more of that. Where I'm more hesitant is that and this is very, very different to certainly the US and most European countries, is the political economy of this country is highly, highly centralized. So you have strong state governments, legislatures that have power. Many European countries, Germany, Spain, Italy, have strong regional authorities and cultures and identities. Our local government in the main, our devolved government, is very, very weak. It has very, very little power. Central government is very, very centrally driven. And so the history of health service reform tends to be clumsy, blunt instruments where the way you've just described it, that's perfect. I would love that. But that's not what tends to happen. What tends to happen is a much less sophisticated interaction with hospitals. For example, they'll come here and they'll say, okay, Guy's and Thomas's, the patient's waiting in the emergency room, you've got 2 percentage points below the national target. How many patients have you got there now? And they'll phone up executives and they'll expect you to know every patient who's in there, how long they're waiting. And that's not how we run an organization of this scale. You have devolved clinical directors doing that. But there's no recognition of the fact that, by the way, we're also running a massive genomic medicine service. We're running the biggest robotic surgery program in Europe. And they treat an organization like that the same as a very small local hospital that's really got none of that complexity. So there has to be some subtlety and differentiation. But the idea of a clever learning system that says, this is what's attainable, we've proven it, and here is our system for helping people both, or requiring people to get there, but also helping them, giving them tools to do the job. If you're too stupid to go and find out what's happening in Manchester, then we'll get someone else who's not as stupid. That's fine. So I like what you've described. It's not the history of how it's tended to work. And that's partly because the founding sort of moment of the health service in this country, the current version of the health service, the National Health Service, was in the post-war command economy moment, 1948, when we'd just come out of a period where the economy was run on a command basis. You had rationing, nationalized industries. And the famous phrase of the founding father of the NHS, Nye Bevan, was that there's a town in Wales where he was from called Tredegar. It's not very famous. That when a bedpan was to be dropped in a hospital in Tredegar, it should echo in the corridors of power in Westminster. I haven't probably got that phrase exactly right, but that's it. So the notion that the Minister of Health should be responsible for every single interaction, which clearly doesn't work. So when I've been quite critical of the way, it's not a criticism necessarily of our politicians, having worked very closely with them. That's the way they're held to account. You know, if something goes wrong in my hospital on corridor B, if it's something bad, you can get patients who will write to the Minister of Health and expect them to account for that. Systemic reform, which interestingly, as we've gone on in this conversation, what it shows is that although we're big, I think, both big believers in technology to be an enabler of change, technology is not really the problem. It's actually system change, it's leadership, it's payment reform, it's regulatory reform, it's culture change, it's professional change. Those are the things we need to change to take the opportunities of these new technologies.
Frankly, I'm not sure I can come up with a better summary to end with, other than possibly to suggest that while system change is the end game and not technology, it might just be technology that will enable system change, and perhaps a complete rethinking of what systems are possible today that may not have been possible a generation ago. What an extraordinary conversation. I really enjoyed it. There are themes we keep seeing, which include the importance of travel and seeking ideas outside of one's own comfort zone to broaden one's perspectives, and of conversing with others in different systems to seek innovation and solutions. Also, the concept of enabling change agents to challenge the status quo. Great. See you in the next one. Hey there, this is Stefano again, and I'm excited to share this new podcast. I traveled the world on my sabbatical, and I was meeting healthcare innovators with incredible stories, and I just want to share them. So let's connect. I want to hear your thoughts. DM me on LinkedIn, and I will reply to every message. And if you like these conversations as much as I did, share the podcast. Give it a like. Your support will help spread these inspiring stories to even more people. Thank you.